This episode of Stage 9 is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
You're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we are continuing our series on Star Trek 14 theoretical director, Quentin Tarantino, with a look at his seventh movie, Django Unchained. So, okay, this is a movie nominated for Best Picture. I believe he won for Best Original Screenplay, if I'm not mistaken. Stars Jamie Foxx and Leonardo DiCaprio and Christoph Waltz and Kerry Washington and numerous other people. And yeah, do you want to give a description of this movie?
Sure. Django Unchained tells the story of a slave who is freed and learns the trade of being a bounty hunter from Christoph Waltz's character. And then they go off in search of his wife, who was taken from him and as punishment, basically. And they go off in search across the countryside, and they wind up at Candyland. Of course, you know, a name that undoubtedly, you know, it's Tarantino. And confront Leonardo DiCaprio to try to procure her freedom. And there you go.
Yeah. Now, you know, this came out after Inglourious Basterds, which was his version of sort of a Western in World War II France. And now this is what he refers to as a Southern. It's even more of a Western than Inglourious Basterds was, but it's still not in the traditional sense because it's not about the frontier. It's about the South, you know, during... I think they say, what, it takes place like 2 years before the Civil War?
Yeah, the opening card says 1858, 2 years before the Civil War.
Yeah. So the production of this, the history of this, you know, is something which he had been working on for a while. And just like all of his other movies, they took various other forms at different points in time. And this was much more of a sprawling epic in its original version, almost in the same way that Kill Bill was. It was, you know, there's basically like 4 hours of footage in this film before it was cut down to its running time of like 2.5 hours. And he ended up shortening it in order to give viewers a complete experience all in one sitting, as opposed to splitting it up into volumes 1 and 2. Because he felt like it needed to be a complete thing. But
yes.
But this character of Django, played by Jamie Foxx, is, I think he sees him as sort of his, I don't know, what his man with no name, I guess would be the analogy.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, isn't he, I haven't seen the one from 1966, because there is a film, because that's why Franco Nero is thanked in the credits, is there was a 1966 film, that was the year, I think, called Django. And so this character is, I always took it as sort of a riff on that character.
Yeah.
Like adapted and changed a little bit to, you know, to bring it up. And, you know, a lot of credit to Tarantino, I think, for not being, you know, Mr. Big Shot Hollywood and just being like, hey, I'll just, no, I just happen to name it that way or something. Like he actually gives credit to the director that inspired the name that he chose, you know, in the credits. So I think that's pretty cool.
And the actor, I think Franco Nero is the actor who played Django, because it says, like, with friendly participation of Franco Nero. And then he's the guy, when they first meet Leonardo DiCaprio, he's the guy who's sitting at the bar and he's like, what's your name? And then Jamie Foxx, you know, says Django and then spells it D-J-A-N-G-O and says the D is silent. And then the guy's like, I know, because that's his, that's him. That's the other
so
Django.
So, but Nero didn't direct the original?
I don't know.
Wasn't he like a actor-director sort of guy? Like, I mean, I could be completely wrong about that, because I knew he was in it, but I thought he had directed it.
No, okay. Nero was in it. It was directed by Sergio Corbucci.
Ah, okay. All right. I don't know why. I guess I just made a leap thinking that Nero had directed it as well.
So. Well, there's that kind of thing that happens in Western. You know, you think about like Clint Eastwood and stuff like
that's,
that.
That's probably why it burned into my brain. You star in a Western in the 1960s, you must have directed it at some point. Yeah. So, yeah.
And I believe it was a series of movies. Yeah. You know, like later on there was, you know, Django Strikes Again, Django Prepare a Coffin. So there is like a history of it, you know, a history of this character. And, you know, this is certainly a completely different take on the character, but inspired by it. And Tarantino has kind of, you know, flirted with the idea of revisiting this character from time to time. You know, next week's movie, The Hateful Eight, was originally meant to be a Django movie. And there's also a comic book by Matt Wagner and Tarantino called, well, it's just Django versus Zorro, or Django and Zorro. And I guess they're not versus each other. It's Django and Zorro together. And what's really interesting is that when there was the whole Sony hack and all of those emails, you know, came out,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
around, you know, a few years back, one of the things which leaked from that correspondence was that the studio was very intent on making a Django Zorro crossover movie. And there was a few emails back and forth where they were like, hey, Tarantino, we'd love to do this with you, you know? And Tarantino was basically like, yeah, that I think that would be fun. You know, we should talk, you know, that kind of thing. But, you know, obviously Tarantino, he's got to pick and choose his projects. There's only so many things that he can do. And I think that that's one of those projects which, you know, sort of was like, I got other things which I can do instead, you know?
Yeah, I could understand that. Although, maybe if Grindhouse had taken off, that would have been, he would have like written it but not directed it. Or like I could have seen a Django and Zorro movie as part of like a Grindhouse double feature sort of thing if that series had really continued or something like that. I could see that happening.
Yeah. And I mean, as far as like why Sony would want to do a Django Zorro movie, this is Tarantino's most profitable film to date. It was a massive hit at the box office. And, you know, Sony owns both of those properties. I think they've been trying to find a way to get Zorro back into the mainstream for a while. And, you know, hey, this could have been it.
But so why do you think it's the most lucrative? Why do you think it's the biggest box office hit? Do you think it's just timing? Do you think people were just ready for something like this? Do you think that this is, you know, are we going to look back and say that's the high water mark for Tarantino and then the rest was just sort of denouement to the 10th?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that it's very good, you know, obviously, you know, as evidenced by the fact that it was, you know, nominated for Best Picture and, you know, won best original screenplay and all that stuff. But I don't know. I mean, maybe it's one of those things where it, you know, I mean, it had a lot of star power behind it, you know, a Jamie Foxx, you know, sort of like vehicle, Jamie Foxx and Leonardo DiCaprio. You got the Tarantino name in there, and it's, I don't know, maybe more accessible than most of his movies. It's not as weird, which sounds strange, you know, because I think in a lot of ways this is the most difficult of his movies to watch, you know?
I agree in a lot of ways, and I think that's one of the things where, because when I rewatch it, like I you know, you look back on Letterboxd and you're like, oh, what did I rate it before? And it's one of those ones where it's never hit 5 out of 5 for me, but it's always hovering around like 4, 4.5. And I think that one of the things is I think that there are a couple of pacing issues here and there, which makes me even more curious about how the 4-hour cut would have played and how thankful I guess I should be that it's 2 hours and 45.
Yeah.
Because there are a couple of points where it's like, you know, you could move it a little bit more, but he really, and this seems strange to say, because he gets more and more comfortable with, you know, gore and violence as things progress. But this, there's something about the violence in this that is more, I don't know. I think this time I tuned in even more to the sound effects that were attendant on the gunshots and the woundings and stuff like that. I think that it's more visually gory, and I think that the sound attached to it wound up being more visceral. I think that makes it very uncomfortable, aside from the fact that the topic itself is something that people don't really want to talk about to begin with.
Yeah, I think it's more, you know, the topic, the subject matter that you know, affects me than the gore. Because, like, one of the things which, I mean, in this movie more than any others of it, like even Kill Bill, like, to me, the gore is just extremely over the top and almost cartoonish. Like, people get shot and, like, literally there's, like, you know, an explosion of, like, a water balloon full of blood just, you know, like,
yes,
splattering. I mean, it's not just, like, you know, blood splatter. It's, like, you know, a blood splash, you know?
Yeah, a guy, like, gets his head cut off and, like, a fountain of blood shoots out of it in Kill Bill. Yeah.
Right, right. But and this is kind of like that, but just with, like, gunshots, you know, where it's, like, so over the top that, to me, in a way, takes the edge off.
But see, the thing is, I would argue that with this, it's not the fount of blood that, you know, that you get in Kill Bill. I mean, the types of guns they were using back then, the woundings that occur aren't that unrealistic because they were firing higher calibers. Like, most of the pistols that he's using only have, I mean, I know that it's a point at the end of it. Oh, I counted 6 shots, and not every gun was 5 shots, but there are plenty of revolvers from that era where the bore was just so large that they could only hold 5 bullets. And I mean, through the Civil War, officers had guns on their hips where, and they would, I mean, you know, this was a more brutal type of, you know, weaponry. It, as crazy as that sounds to say, but it wasn't about delivering a compact, you know, packet of force. It was about delivering a lead ball that was going to tear you apart.
Right.
You know, sort of technology. And so, like, when people get shot in the kneecaps and the head and stuff like that, it's actually not too far off, I don't think. I think that, if anything, this is probably closer to the way it really was than what we've been used to with the sanitized version of gunfighting in film, you know, traditionally throughout history. So, I mean, that's my take on it. But I still think it's uncomfortable. Like, a lot of the violence is uncomfortable to watch. It's purposely so. But, I have spent a lifetime desensitizing myself to violence, and Django is still a movie that makes me cringe from time to time.
But, like, I don't know, like, the gunshots and stuff are not what do it for me. It's, you know, I think what it is, you know, the sort of the stuff which is more personal, you know, and I think the thing that really bothers me is, like, the cruelty on display, you know?
Like, oh, yeah, for sure.
Like, you really, I mean, it's there's definitely numerous scenes in there where you're just sort of, like, in awe of how terrible these people are to each other, you know?
Yeah, but at the same time, that in and of itself exposes, you know, something that is not comfortable to acknowledge. There's almost a lot of times with films, even if they take, you know, a stance exposing the horrors and the ills and the evils of the era, they do it in a fashion, like, this is a terrible word to use for it, but Tarantino embraces that and basically puts it on display to say, no, everything that happened was god-awful and would make you cringe, would make anybody with any sort of sensibility after that era look back and say, how could you do this? Right. How could you even process that? And I think that one of the things that really highlights the disconnect is you see how brutal all of this treatment is, and then Leonardo DiCaprio, you know, the sticking point for him is you have to give me a handshake because that's, you know, a proper and gentlemanly thing to conduct business with. And it's like everybody was a sociopath in this. Yeah. And I think it rightly shines a big spotlight on that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's the cruelty on display, but then, you know, the sort of like topper to that is how every day it seems. How every person, you know, whether they're the victims or the victimizers, they're kind of just treating it like this is the way things are, you know? And it's like, I mean, it's just insane to think that is how it was, but it is, you know? And I think that goes a long way to, you know, Tarantino's reasons behind not wanting to split it up into two parts, because it is so hard to watch, and there is so much cruelty on display that when you get to the end, you know, not to ruin, you know, what happens, but just to say that there is a certain amount of catharsis there with that ending, you know, and there is
certainly
like this sort of, you know, joyous moment that you get. And I think that you need that when you leave the theater, because if you leave halfway through, you're going to be leaving in a very dark place. And I, you know, I don't think that's, you know, I'm not going to say that's not his intention. Obviously that is his intention, is to put you in that place, to put you in that dark place to make you think about, you know, what it is that you're seeing. But I don't think he wants to leave you there. You know what I mean?
I do. I think that there's also, you know, a sense of, when you see all of the violence on display, I'll just because it's top of mind, because, you know, I saw it recently, I've talked about it recently, but with Punisher, there's typically with your vengeance stories, there's a, you know, you don't want to see the hero get too brutal or too violent with people and those sorts of things. I think that a lot of the hyper violence in this serves to you cheering Django on,
yeah,
when he throws it back on people and is just as brutal with them.
Yeah.
You don't feel any sort of pit, like a normal person seeing somebody being, you know, shot or brutalized or whatever is going to be like, oh, that's terrible. But with Django, you need to sit there and say, yes, do it. Make that happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I think that there's also a big difference between sort of like the way that Django goes about it compared to, you know, the way that, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio's character goes about it or whatever, you know, that kind of thing too. You know, it's weird. I mean, just like, you know, all of Tarantino's movies, he's walking a very fine line here, you know, and he took a lot of criticism for this movie. You know, I mean, there were, you know, many people who were kind of outspoken over, you know, maybe taking in some places a lighter tone with the subject of slavery, you know, and I mean, I can totally understand that criticism. I think that what he's trying to do here and the way that he goes about it is very effective for me, you know, but I mean, I can understand why people would respond negatively to it for sure, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there was a part of me that wondered while I was watching it this time, and I've been trying to figure out the right way to frame the question, but a thought that did come to me was, is this a movie that in a sense is very necessary to show like a really unbridled, unvarnished view of the brutality and the awfulness there? Does this stand a chance of being made if it's not Tarantino or somebody like Tarantino making it? Does it make like somebody else comes in with this script who's not Tarantino? Does it make the studio balk and say, not touching it, not going to do it. Like, isn't it possible that it needed to be Tarantino to do this? And maybe we can, you know, so long as I'm talking about, we'll look back in the hind mirror, but maybe we look at Django also as a watershed moment where it's like, it was done, it worked, and it opened the door for later works to come along and explore it in their own way and in different ways and stuff like that.
I mean, that could be, you know, I mean, in terms of the tone and everything, I mean, I don't think that studios are necessarily afraid of, you know, dealing with the topic of slavery, you know, in a brutal way either. I mean, you look at like 12 Years a Slave and stuff like that, you know, but this is certainly different in that it is a much more stylized portrayal of events.
Yeah,
you know?
but I mean, like, sort of the consistent brutality and the storyline of a, you know, an Avenger like Django coming through. Like, there are plenty of films that explore the topic and they have brutality, but there's almost a more, like, and this is where I'm really struggling for words, but the focus isn't on somebody who then picks up a gun and comes in like the Punisher and starts laying waste to everything. It's right. Always, it's almost like they're keeping that idea at arm's length until Tarantino shows up and says, no, I'm going to have my hero do this. And
yeah, because in a lot of ways that's kind of a fantasy element, you know, just like Inglourious right. Bastards is basically a fantasy element. And there is, you know, a certain amount of catharsis, which is, you know, I mean, like, I'll never forget, like, being at a movie theater, as Inglourious Bastards was getting out, and, you know, just a random guy, like, you know, came up to me and was like, "Oh, that movie was crazy. You know, seeing what happens to Hitler in that movie is insane, since, you know, that's not exactly historically accurate, but, you know, boy, it felt good to see that, you know?" And, like, I think that that's kind of what he's tapping into with, you know, Inglourious Bastards and with Django Unchained. You know, he is showing, you know, the evil. He is showing the brutality and the inhumanity, which, you know, was very much a reality, you know, at these points in history, but even today, of course. But he's also sort of like giving the audience almost like the ability to sort of take a breath from it, you know? I mean, I'm just not going to deal with that now. I mean, but to sort of like have that cathartic moment in a sense. And I don't know. Yeah. I mean, it's weird. It's all of his movies are very, very complex in terms of that stuff, in terms of dealing with, like, you know, I mean, he's someone who in all of his movies, like, he'll make you laugh and then you'll sit there and be like, should I really be laughing at this? Like, maybe that's wrong of me, you know? And I think that he does that intentionally because I think he wants you to think about that. He wants you to sort of like go back and analyze what it is you saw and what your reaction to it was and why you had that reaction. And I think that that's definitely true with this movie, you know? I mean, I can tell you that, I mean, as someone who has seen 12 Years a Slave and who has seen this, just, you know, as another example that came out, you know, like a year or two, you know, later or whatever, this, even though 12 Years a Slave was a much more serious movie and a much more realistic, you know, depiction of slavery and everything like that, and sort of like a more, I don't know, analytical look at the problem, like, I've definitely thought more about, you know, the morality behind it, you know, and sort of like the complexity of the issue by watching Django Unchained, because it makes me think about, like, my personal feelings. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I do. I think there's a lot of validity to that. And I think that, you know, just in terms of, because, you know, like you pointed out, this is a Southern, it's not set in the West sort of thing. There was a moment watching it this time, because this is the first time I've watched it since Hateful Eight came out, where they're going through and they're like, you know, in the snowy mountains or whatever, and they're going along. And I I had this moment where I wondered to myself, is this where Hateful Eight was born? This shot right here, because you see the snowy mountains and them going along. And I was like, this feels like a moment where he watched it back and was like, that'd be a good setting. A cabin in the snow.
I'm pretty sure it was with Hateful Eight that he said this, because it's hard to tell, because it's like Inglourious Bastards is a Western, but it's also a, you know, a war movie or whatever. And then, you know, Django Unchained is much more of a traditional Western. And, you know, he said this about Kill Bill too and everything, but he's like, I made a Western. I figured out how to make a Western, you know, through the process of making it. Now that I have those tools, I feel like I should use them to make another one, because this time through, I wouldn't be figuring it out. I would just be doing everything properly right off the bat. So I think that that was one of the reasons why he really did want to do a Western with Hateful Eight. And like we were saying, it was originally supposed to be a Django movie. It was going to be called Django in White Hell. And the
that
Samuel
would have been a pretty
Jackson,
solid title.
Yeah, yeah. And that is the name of a chapter in later on in the movie. You know, they refer to, you know, White Hell. But the Sam Jackson character was going to be Django. And what he learned over the course of, you know, developing the movie was that that character had to have so much hate in him that he couldn't do that to Django. You know, he doesn't want Django to be a hateful character. He wants Django to be morally superior across the board. So he couldn't put Django into the Hateful Eight, because he's not. It would be like Django and the Hateful Seven, you know, doesn't quite have the same ring to it. So that's why, you know, he altered that. But he's talked about, and I would not be surprised if we see this character pop up elsewhere. I mean, maybe not in a movie, you know, but he's talked about wanting to do a paperback, you know, with this character or whatever.
I would love that so much.
Yeah,
I really would. I mean, I'd love it if he just did. You know, who knows? Maybe he gets behind the idea, but like even in, like an anthology series where it's like, you know, just do like a one shot, you know, one season, 13 episodes or something like that. And, you know, bring in other directors that you want to, you know, highlight them or what have you. And just have a series where it's jumping around. I mean, I could almost see Django is almost like a Kane from Kung Fu type of character.
Yeah,
where he wanders around doing right and setting things right.
Yeah, yeah, I could see that too. You know, I could definitely see like a comic book series or something, or a series of short stories or whatever. You know, it could definitely be done in various formats and work well. I mean, we've already seen in comic books, you know, Tarantino supervised an adaptation of the movie as a comic book, in which he does expand on it and put all that stuff that he cut out of the movie into the comic. So if you want to see what was missing, you know, and everything, then, you know, you can. And he's also, since he did shoot all of that stuff, he has talked about, you know, cutting it up into like a 4-part miniseries to air on HBO or something like that. So that's certainly another possibility. And then we do have the Django Zorro crossover. And, you know, who knows what else he's going to do with it, you know? But I could definitely see him doing more stuff with Django. And I haven't read those comics, but I really want to. I think I need to make that a priority. You know?
Yeah. You know, as you talk about him, I do too. You know, and the thing is, I this won't happen, and I'm not campaigning for it, but how funny. Like, you almost wonder, you know, could they travel through time in his Star Trek movie and happen across Django? That I would love, but it wouldn't happen.
They could easily do like a Spectre of the Gun thing or something like that and end up in the Old West. It's never happened. It's not like it's never happened in Star Trek before.
Oh, that would be pretty awesome.
Yeah. Oh, well. But I don't think it'll happen, because Django, I think, is a Sony movie and Star Trek is Paramount, so... That's probably going
to
be the biggest.
Curse you, studios. Just sell yourselves to Disney so we can all get it over with already. Just become one giant studio.
Yeah. It's easy to travel through time. It's not so easy to get, you know, studios like Paramount and Sony to work together. You know.
There you go. Yeah.
Oh, well. I mean, I'm just going to say it's been fun. It's been very interesting talking about Django. I don't know. It's certainly, I mean, I haven't stopped. It's not a movie which I revisit frequently. You know, out of the Tarantino things, like, I'm going to gravitate towards something like Jackie Brown or Kill Bill because it's fun, you know? Whereas Django certainly has enjoyable moments, but it's a hard movie to watch, you know?
I agree.
And because of that, like, I don't really revisit it very often at all, you know? But when I do, I think about it probably a lot more than I do his other movies, you know? So, yeah. I mean, I guess that's saying something right there, you know? And I do totally understand, you know, the criticism associated with the film. And, you know, I think about that a lot too, you know? And it pushes buttons, and maybe it pushes them a little too hard. I don't know. But it's certainly, if it does nothing else, it gets you thinking for sure, you know, about some very important topics. And I think that because of that, it's extremely successful.
Completely agree. And once again, we've pointed to it before, once again shows that Tarantino has the social commentary chops that so many of us enjoy in Star Trek.
So, oh, yeah, for sure, yeah. For sure. And, you know, he's not going to just, you know, sort of like pick a topic and, I guess, preach to the choir in a sense. I mean, obviously, yes, you say, like, slavery is bad. Yes, okay, I guess that, in a sense, that is preaching to the choir, but I think he gets a lot deeper than that with this movie, you know? And he really sort of starts, you know, digging into, you know, people's beliefs and making them challenge their own beliefs and sort of making them, you know, reflect inwardly a lot more. And I mean, you see that here. You see that in all of his movies, I think, you know, to some degree or another. But yeah, he's kind of a master at that when he chooses to tackle it, which is not always, you know. He's not dealing with any social commentary in Death Proof, but here he is, and definitely makes you think, you know?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It does.
All right. Well, it's definitely been interesting talking about Django Unchained today, but that's not all we're talking about this week on Trek FM, so here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
But aside from a title, it was just getting people used to the idea that Star Trek did not have to be Kirk, Spock, McCoy, either watching them get older or recast. You know, it wasn't a zero-sum binary choice here, that there was some other way you could go with the franchise, that the franchise was more than these guys. The franchise was this universe.
Earl Grey.
Is it Worf being hit with pain sticks in the Icarus Factor?
Dang it!
No.
Oh, I forgot about that one.
I know, I was going to choose it, and I thought, you know, Richard's probably going to, you know, take up that Worf one.
I forgot about that one. Oh, yeah. All right. Well, I would choose that one, but that's not what I have on my list.
Okay.
I completely forgot about that episode. Oh, my gosh.
The Edge, a Star Trek Discovery podcast.
It's weird that they don't have a lot of sunglasses. Like, wouldn't sunglasses be huge there?
Oh, man, I just thought of something. Is Iris Stephen Bear from the Mirror Universe?
Checks out.
Primitive Culture. A look at history and culture through Star Trek.
Is the choice universally impossible? That something that everyone would struggle with? Or is it impossible because it's being struggled with by that particular character? So this, I think, and this choice is particularly difficult for Sarek because he's an unusual Vulcan. It wouldn't be difficult for any other Vulcan.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And the other Vulcan basically says, you're acting like human.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
But then he married a human.
He did, yeah.
And he had a human, half-human son. Yeah. And he adopted a human.
So he's obviously got some...
Yeah, and so
he's unusual in that.
In Star Trek, is there any other choice which is impossible because of that individual rather than impossible because it's like a universally seen impossible choice?
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app, and get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and in most third-party apps. And you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link as well. We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there's many ways for you to do that. The best place to join the larger conversation is the Babel Conference, which is our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Just choose to send to a show and select Stage 9. That will come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Look for Kessel Junkie. That's me going around on the internet. You can also find me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig, and you can find me over on the Nerd Party Network co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations with Matthew Rushing and Great Shot Kid with the charming and 1 year older Mike Schindler.
Yes, you can find me over there on thenerdparty.com doing Great Shot Kid. And you can also find me right here on Trek.fm doing The Edge, specifically Tracks from The Edge, where we provide audio commentaries for every single episode of Star Trek Discovery. We'd like to thank our associate producers today, Jeff Sutter, Chris Steftenagel, and Norman C. Lau.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, guys. If you'd like to be like Chris, Jeff, and Norm, head on over to patreon.com and become a patron of the network. If you go to patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll get all the details. Perks include early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more, available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. Okay, so that's movie number 7 for Quentin Tarantino. Next week is his latest movie. You know, he's working on another one right now, which won't be out until next year. But next week, we will cover the most current Quentin Tarantino feature film, The Hateful Eight. ¶¶